I'd like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Saturday, May 11, 2019, and the time is 9 a.m. Joining us today is Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Sylvan Leonard, Representative Ortiz will be right back, and Representative Merrick is excused today, and I'm Co-Chair Wilson. And today before us, we have HB 139 to start with, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption. And with that, Representative Johnston, will you please come to the table? Please put yourself on the record and any other individual you would like to join you. I think that would mean your staff on that.
Good morning, Co-Chair Wilson and Co-Chair Chair Foster. For the record, I'm Jennifer Johnston, and I represent House District 28. Thanks for your willingness to consider House Bill 139 this morning. House Bill 139 grants an additional exemption from procurement code to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for the purposes of evaluating and managing investments. The types of investments that this exemption would apply to are often very profitable for our state. Under existing law, the corporation exempt from the state's procurement code when it acquires income-producing assets or delegates its investment authority. However, they must comply with the state's procurement code when evaluating and managing the assets in which they invest. The change proposed in this bill will allow a timeline that better aligns with the pace of the markets in which the corporation works and will result in a more streamlined process. My staff and I are available to answer questions, as is Andrew Rodell, the Chief Executive Officer of the corporation.
Any questions? Representative Sylvan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. Johnston, can you give us an example of why changing statute would be important for the Permanent Fund Corporation?
I can, and I also, if it's the chair would not mind, I'd like to ask Angela Rodell up also.
Ms. Rodell, could you please join them at the table? Did you want to go ahead and answer Ms. Johnston or have Ms. Rodell?
And I can start, and I'll let Angela finish, but as you might know, the corporation is involved in a number of private equities, which direct investment, and that is a case where if we don't have this, a lot of the cost of evaluating the private equity goes to a manager who would then have to, they would get part of the upside and charge more than maybe we could by directly contracting with expertise. And Angela or Ms. Rodell?
Please put yourself on the record and help us out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Representative Johnston is correct. There's a lot of private investments that the Permanent Fund makes that require subject matter expertise or that we need to go through the procurement process in order to, if we want to invest directly. So the way that this works right now is that we'll hire other managers and then they can move more rapidly. This will allow us to streamline and reduce fees on some of those investments.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So you would say then, Ms. Rodell, that there's also a time element involved. Instead of going through a timely piece, you're able to move quickly. Therefore, your investments are able to be secure.
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, Ms. Rodell, how long has the Permanent Fund been without this ability? And is there, I guess what I'm saying, is there any downside at all to making this, any opportunity cost at all to making this adjustment?
Through the chair, we have not had this since our inception. So, you know, for 40 years, I think where this is more relevant is we were allowed to start doing private equity in around 2008, 2009 timeframe. So this is a more recent development where it's been more challenging for us.
And
follow up?
Is there any downside at all? Is there any added risk or anything at all to making this adjustment?
Through the chair, no.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Rodell, I guess I'm trying to understand how procurement code applies to what you do. So you're looking so you can, I guess what you're looking to do is be able to enter into contracts with external fund managers on a short form contract, so 10 days to write a contract. And I guess I'm not familiar with the state's procurement code, so how does it relate to sole source contracts or what we did in the local government was allowed informal bid process, three bidders, you know, in the short form, but it had a limited dollar amount. So I'm not, enlighten me a little bit on the state's procurement code, please.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp. So right now, as the sponsor stated, we are fully subject to the state procurement code except for buying investments themselves. So if you think about it, we can expend $250 million to buy an office building, but we can't directly hire an engineer or an architect to evaluate the stability of that building without going through the state procurement code. The state procurement code has a timeline attached to it in terms of having it online, open for bid for a period of time. That tends to be 14 to 21 days. You have the process of then getting all the bids in, creating a committee, evaluating the bids, scoring the bids, doing a notice. We're required to put a 10-day notice period out of intent to award so that if there's any protest against the process, that can come in. So when buildings are, in this example, if the building is for sale and it has a 30-day open period to do that, we may miss that window because we're going through a procurement process to hire an architect. There is, under the state procurement code, a limited process. You can do that limited process so long as the contracts are less than $100,000. In some cases, the subject matter requirements are in excess of $100,000. So that does not make that pathway feasible for us.
Follow up?
So currently, you can purchase investment properties up to $250 million outside the procurement code?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, we can buy any investment of any size.
Okay. So the concern is if you had to have architects, engineers, if you wanted building inspectors, and you think that would exceed $100,000?
Through the chair, that was just one example. This is whether or not we want to hire doctors or medical researchers to look into a biotech venture capital investment, any type of expertise where they're not acting as the fiduciary. Fund managers have a fiduciary requirement to them. So that's the third party outsourcing that the sponsor referred to. This is really in an effort to make direct investments so that we can eliminate those fund manager fees and have that expertise at the table advising us in a timely manner, because quite honestly, a lot of investments happen very quickly within 3 months. We don't get, you know, 4 months to evaluate an investment. They just don't stick around that long.
Follow up? That's final. So in them investments, and we know it takes time to close deals, but what happened to the earnest money agreements and the options for tying things up? We don't operate in that method. I mean, sometimes it takes 6 months or a year to close a deal, but we usually tie them up with a good faith, you know, or earnest money agreement or something.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, that doesn't, those features are not in private equity transactions.
So how many investments have we lost because you did not have this ability?
Chair Wilson, that's hard to quantify. We look at probably 6 to 10 investments a year that we would like to put through this process. So if we are passing on maybe 5 to 10 investments possibly, I don't have a good number for you on that.
But you passed on those 5 to 10 because you can't get through the process, or were there other reasons why you passed on them?
It could be due to a number of reasons, and if we feel strongly about the investment and the process is a problem, we'll go to a fund manager and ask them to take a look at it, put it through their process, and pay them their fees for that.
So if I understand there, so there's another way of going through the process or around the process. Mm-hmm. It just costs a different fee that you would not have to have if we were to pass this bill.
That is correct, and it's much more expensive.
Could you get that documentation to us so we can understand a little bit more about how much something like that would cost?
I think that documentation is going to be difficult. We'll get something to you, but to give the committee a sense of what we're talking about, when we do investments through a fund manager, they're often entitled to a share of excess profit. So you include in the agreement a threshold of performance. So there's an expectation that you'll get, I'm going to make up a number, 5%, 7%, 10% on the investment. If there's excess profit over and above that return expectation, that excess is also known as carried interest, and the fund is entitled to a percentage of that. The industry standard is that they get 20% of that excess profit, and the permanent fund would get 80% of that excess profit. If we make a direct investment, we're going to capture all of that excess profit. And so that's why it's hard to quantify the cost. And what we want to do and the effort we've been making with internal management is this ability to do more direct investing. This initiative, this bill before you, does not ask for a full procurement exemption, and I just want to make that clear for the record. We're not seeking a full exemption from the state procurement code. What we're asking for is expanded authority on making direct investments to bring in the expertise that we're looking for so that we can return more of this excess profit to the state of Alaska.
So could you give us any information on the last 5 years? I mean, how you've gone around and you've utilized, you know, the process you just talked about. I mean, we're just trying to figure out how many times you've kind of butted against the wall of what you currently have, that you've had to go to a different type of management and do exactly what you just described.
Okay. We will do our best to get something to you, Representative Wilson.
Appreciate that. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to go back to a previous question concerning risk. The capabilities that you're looking for right now, you can currently do. It just takes longer.
Through the chair, that's correct.
And so the concept here is that we're just wanting to decrease the amount of time that it takes. And I understand that that can have a reduced cost. If things take longer, generally they cost more. The question that I would have is, generally, if you're doing things in a shorter period of time, you're also have a higher risk involved in some form or fashion. So I would like to better understand why getting things done quicker doesn't impact risk.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, when we do due diligence on an investment and we want to make a direct investment, the window is open for a period of time. And that window is usually around 30 to 45 days. What we're looking to have happen here is to be able to hire subject matter experts that can weigh in and assist us on that due diligence. The state procurement code does not allow us to move quickly into that time frame. In terms of reducing risk, I think by having these subject matter experts with us within 10 days and then spending 30 days side by side with us looking at it, as opposed to relying on what we're being told without that third party verification, creates a different risk profile. So there's risks in both, but our effort here is not to increase risk, but to give us more comfort in our due diligence process.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Riddell, the first thing I want to make sure I understand is the you said under the current system, we pay a fee for an expert through an investment manager, I guess. and then they, on the upside, collect a share of profit from one of our investments? Is that what you said?
Through the chair, that is correct. So if we see an investment now and can't move on the time frame, we have funds that we can put investments into. The fund manager then goes and hires the diligence expertise, but because they're managing that fund and collecting both a management fee and an entitlement for excess profit.
Follow up?
I've always thought I was in the wrong business. I mean, not always. But this sounds like there's no downside for them, that because they get a fee, and on the if the investment's profitable, they get part of that profit. Is that what you just said?
Through the chair, yes. And what they're doing is they are acting as a fiduciary. So they have a fiduciary threshold, and if they see this investment, they have to put it through their investment committee. And if they disagree with us, then they can say no and don't believe it meets certain requirements. So they are at risk. Their company is at risk. Their fund is at risk. They don't rubber stamp these investments. That's not the process. So thank you for allowing me to clarify that.
Follow up?
Can the public, including the legislature, if you were exempted from procurement for purposes of these investment-related services, can we see that? Is that we can see all of that activity in your books? Is it? And mind you, we're generally too busy to look. But is it something that we could see if we wanted to see it?
Through the chair. Representative Josephson, you mean see the underlying investments that are being made, the direct investments being made, or I'm just asking for a little clarification.
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
So follow up. So if you wanted to buy another building in Manhattan and you were worried about the stability of the building and hired an engineer architect, could we see under this bill, could we see what you paid for that process?
Oh. Yes, absolutely. Through the chair, absolutely, yes. And we report quarterly all the expenses associated with investments.
Follow up?
And if we someday had a director who was less ethical and highly regarded as yourself, is there some risk that this could just become a air quotes, relationship that is taken advantage of by the expert, that is, or are these such discrete, variable contracts? I mean, if there are hundreds of these, then there doesn't seem to carry much risk. But if there's one person who is an architect in Denver, and we always hire that person, then maybe it does. And I just wanted to get a sense of that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that's a very fair question, and I think it's important for us to at the permanent fund to continue to have processes for distributing these contracts when we need these efforts and walking through what our internal process would be on some of these things. And we use a number of outside consultants to help weigh in. For example, we have a general real estate consultant, RCL Co., that can weigh in on this. And so putting those processes together to make sure that it passes the smell test. I think the other place you're going to have a sense of this is in the performance of the portfolio, because arguably you will see, as a result of making these investments and the due diligence that has been done on these investments should perform. And so hopefully that there will be both a process looking into as well as the investments themselves and what they return for the state.
Thank you.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're mixing apples and oranges here a little. When you talk about purchasing a commercial building out of state, that goes through a different process. Someone mentioned a earnest money agreement, a timeline. Due diligence could be an engineer's report, an appraisal, and other types of documentation. What we're talking about here is the global market for venture capital investments. We're talking about working with a fund manager that's presenting an opportunity for the Alaska Permanent Fund to invest in maybe a business in a global sense. Would that be true?
Through the chair, I think it's all those things, Representative Laban. I think that it is both an engineer on a building, and it's the a market assessment for being able to sell widgets in Europe. So it's all of those things.
A follow-up.
Follow-up.
The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation would still have fiduciary responsibility to follow due diligence. You're not trying to shortcut that process here.
Through the chair, absolutely not.
And if I may, you're still directly responsible for your actions. You have to build an expertise base for use by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for making investments, any kind of investments. What you're looking for is a little bit of flexibility in building that expertise base to call on these experts in a quick fashion within a timeline that fits the opportunity to make the investment so you could be more flexible and responsive to the market. Would that be a fair statement?
Through the chair, that's absolutely fair.
Thank you.
It doesn't matter if it's an in-house investor, if they're in-house or out of the house, if you're on this procurement portion of it. So if I have somebody who's, you know, working for the permit fund, you know, here in Juneau, making, you know, buying the building and doing that, is that different than if you're contracting somebody out to look for those kind of investments?
Through the chair, if I understand you correctly, if we do it, we have to go through the procurement process. If we make an investment into a fund and they do it, then we don't have to go through the procurement process for that expertise.
And that would be for buildings as well, not just for?
It's for anything, Madam Chair.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Riddell, my understanding is that a similar bill has been before the legislature before. Do you know if anyone spoke against it or had any concerns, and if so, what those concerns were, number one. Number two, as we look at pros and cons, are there any cons that we should be aware of?
Chair Foster, what has been before, what has been in the past has been a full procurement exemption similar to that used by the Alaska Retirement Management Board, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, ADA, all the other quasi-agencies similar to APFC have a full exemption. This, rather than seeking that, given the discomfort of full procurement generated from various members, we looked at, is there a way to get to 90-95% of what we need? And this was the compromise that we came up with. This is at our request. We've, as you mentioned, we've been seeking procurement relief now since before I came into this position 3.5 years ago. It has been a priority of the Board of Trustees. And so I think for us, we don't see cons to this other than it's not a full procurement. Ideally, in a perfect world, we'd get a full procurement exemption, similar to what our peers have in this state.
Great. Thank you. So it sounds like the answer to the concern was we'll do a more targeted procurement and a narrowly defined procurement exemption. So thank you.
Yeah. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While I certainly don't want to defend a procurement, state's procurement code process that's 54 days and longer. Seems like maybe there's some room for improvement there, but I don't know. What processes or requirements are going to be not complied with this exemption? What is it? What's the purpose of having the 54 plus days in the code as it stands right now? I don't know. What are we not going to be doing?
And I guess that's where I'm at, too. I'm just trying to really figure out whether or not the system overall is just broken and we shouldn't be taking as long as we're doing and versus that. I know you make a lot more investments and probably have a lot more procurement than most other agencies do, but I think what we're struggling a little bit here is trying to figure out whether or not we do this exemption or whether or not, and it's not your problem, the whole system's broken, but I think that's what we're just trying, that's where I'm trying to get to at least as well.
Representative Wilson and through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think the challenge you're seeing is that the state procurement code is written to accommodate procuring everything from pencils to computers to office space to chairs and desks and everything that state government needs to operate. And it's written in with more commodity acquisition in mind than services, quite honestly, in mind. And I think it's designed to give comfort to the public that there is a competitive process and that you're taking lowest cost. In our case, what it's also doing is it's requiring us to pay more for some of these services than we otherwise would because we're having to go do an alternative method of procuring the service. And for us, on investment, this is just related to investment-related services. The language is very clear on that. And I think that's what you have to weigh in the balance. And for us, I can't speak to the procurement code for Department of Transportation or Department of Education. I just know that for us on this particular piece of it is that we have had as an effort to bring more of the decision-making back to Juneau. And the reason we want that decision-making on investments here in Juneau is because we think we can better align those decisions with what is happening in the state and what our investment goals are at the Permanent Fund. And we see an opportunity to create value for the state. And I think that's been demonstrated. When I, 4 years ago, when I started, the fund was at $52 billion. Today it's at $66 billion, and that's after transferring $2.7 billion for FY19 to the state treasury. So there's a lot that's being asked of the permanent fund. There's being a lot asked of APFC, and we take our stewardship of this fund very seriously, and we do look for ways that we can reduce costs in managing this fund. We think we do it very effectively and very efficiently, and what we believe this will help us do is give us the tools to tap into expertise that we don't currently have, that we don't need on a day-to-day basis, and reduce the cost of making the investment, which in turn increases the possibility of return, more return coming to the state, which is something I think we are really focused on at this time.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I still don't know what it is that's not going to be done, and I don't know that you're the right person to answer that question because you're not in charge of the procurement process. I'm concerned that we have a procurement process that's unwieldy, and I get the pain that you're feeling. I don't think the right answer is to, every time we feel pain in our process, to exempt the people who are feeling the pain from it, because there's a purpose for having a procurement process. The fact that it's unwieldy and it's a bureaucratic process that needs to be improved doesn't equate to justification for exempting from the process. It means the process needs to be fixed. So without understanding what it is that we're giving up here in the sense of why we have a process in place, it would be difficult for me to support giving an exemption when I don't know what it is we're exempting from.
Well, we can have, we can reach out to the department administration and we can bring someone in on the procurement within itself. I think that could answer your question on our next hearing. Representative Foster, did you have something?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Carpenter's concern, I think it's one that a number of us probably have. I don't know if it's helpful if there was like either a chart that shows what the procurement normally would be and then what it is now that says this is the first step, second step, third step, and then this is what changes, flow diagram or something, just throwing that out there.
Representative Foster, I think in some of the information associated with the sponsor statement, we did provide the time frame, and so you can see it's the having to post a minimum of 21 days a bid, an opportunity to bid. You have to do it for 21 days. You have to give time, we assume it usually takes 5 to 10 days then to review and evaluate and rank proposals. And then you have to do an issue notice of intent
so
to
award. Reading, so just make sure that everybody understands. So in everybody's packet, just try to get everybody at the same spot. It's a little easier to follow along. So in your packet from Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation on page 2, it lists all the things that Ms. Rodell is talking about. I guess where the question would versus reading the entire statement to us, where in this, is it just one of these lines that we're talking about changing, all the rest of this happens except one line, or does it change everything? What you have here, is that completely different than what is currently required?
Right. So, Madam Chair, we wouldn't post this for 21 days and give 21 days. We would reach out to a limited number of people. We would hopefully get their responses back within a couple of days. So this would not be posted for a minimum of 21 days.
So that's the only thing in this chart that changes is the 21 days?
No, and we would not have a 10-day protest period. We're required to have a mandatory 10-day protest period, and that would go away as well. So that's 31 days right there that you're taking off the process.
So if someone disagrees, there would be no process for them to be able to basically whatever the Permanent Fund Corporation decided, and if somebody said they didn't do something right, because that's usually what a protest happens, is that maybe, you know, the contract changed or didn't go out to enough people. What happens if truly, again, it kind of comes back to, we kind of have to go by who's not necessarily sitting, it's not you sitting in the seat, but it's somebody else. What is someone's ability if they don't agree with what's happened? So if you're taking the protest portion out of it, that would give no one an ability to be able to protest.
That's correct, because the idea is to be able to hire the subject matter experts. We don't expect to see a lot of bidding on this, and these wouldn't go out to bid. These would look at these are now through the funds in a lot of ways. I'm not going to say they're not sole source contracts, but they're limited source contracts. There's, on some of these, there's very few people that you can go to and get their expertise without them having and being able to weigh in on that.
And although I understand and agree that there still could be a problem once in a while where the process, somebody skips a step by accident. I'm not going to say, I don't think anybody does any of this on purpose. But to take away the ability of someone who feels that they have not been treated fairly and not to have that ability, maybe 10 days is too long. You know, that's perhaps maybe 1 or 2 days. I think most people follow this close enough that if I was a bidder or went out to and I didn't get it, I don't necessarily think you need 10 days to do it. But I guess I am somewhat concerned that there would be none. Representative Johnston?
Yes. Yes, Chair Wilson. I think what we're asking here is a degree of flexibility. And I'd like to go back to the whole private equity investment. And I think maybe a number of you are familiar with how fast that market is going right now. I'd like to say Silicon Valley. I would like to say the biomedical field, and the permanent fund, and I'll, when I'm done, we'll ask the director, but to get in on the ground floor of some of these investments without a fund manager, you have to be very flexible, have to be good, but very flexible. And so there was an investment that the fund made a number of years ago, which we are now reaping the benefits of. So did the fund manager reap the benefits of. And that was a biomedical fund that we were able to directly invest in before it went to the market for other investors. And we did get a huge upside on it, but also the fund manager got a rather large upside on this. We now are starting to get sophisticated enough in this state and in this fund to be able to do some of this ourselves. I do not see taking huge risk, but to be able to hire the very, very small group of people that can analyze this, whether we should be in it or not. And I guess the question to the committee is, do you want to stay with the status quo, where we are really dependent on other fund managers, and we may be, will be safe. I'm not sure how much safer, but we could be safe because we're following the procurement code, and we will not be making maybe as much on our investment, and that's sort of the question. Or do you want to have a little bit of flexibility built in there that would allow the fund with strong expertise to help us and to get us in there at the table on these private equities? And I would like to ask the director, do you see this being used an exorbitant amount of time, or do you see this, I mean, is this something that we'll be using like 10 times over a year?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I would expect we would be using this about 10 to 12 times a year at most. Part of it is the limitations. We are putting to work in private equity approximately $1.2 billion, $1.3 billion a year. So if you assumed all of it needed this, that's roughly 10 investments of $100 million each. But not every investment needs this. So that's how I get to maybe 10.
So, you know, not that I completely disagree with the representative, but I think the due diligence of this committee is to make sure that this is the right amount of time. And do we take away other portions of it, like being able to appeal, or do we just shorten that amount of time, because 10 days may be too much? But, you know, this is a lot of money. This is giving away some checks and balances that's been in place. And so I think everybody wants to let the corporation make as many of the choices that they can, but at the same time, we have a due diligence to the public to make sure that we're also making sure that check and balance is there. We have quite a bit of list of questions still. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll I'll make this my last round here.
You're more than free to ask whatever questions. I mean, we need to make sure that we understand this.
Yeah. Well, and I'm trying to learn here in this process as well. So, and first, I want to thank Ms. Rodell for acknowledging the fact that the unrest with the exemptions from the procurement code. You know, we went through that last year with DOC, and then this year, Mr. O'Dell, with you saw the sole source contract here let out in the media lately, and we have a new administration, you have new board members, so it creates a lot of uncertainty for us, exemptions from procurement code. For me, I won't speak for everybody, but it does for me for sure. So what I'm trying to understand is two things. Is one, how do you, so we manage our funds, our assets, to external fund managers and internal fund managers. So when we acquire investment instruments, real estate, whatever it may be, when that's being, so managing assets and acquiring them, two separate processes. So in the external fund managers, do the external fund managers also acquire them investment instruments at discretion? And if so, or does it all come through you and your board before them are made? And if so, who does the due diligence on them? Does it the external fund manager's responsibility, or do we do it in-house?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, external fund managers will do their own due diligence, hire their own due diligence experts, and some of that is done. We don't direct 100% of the investment activity.
So, so for those investment instruments that we buy that are internally managed, is where this is going to apply to for our needs, our services. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
For the internal. So this new move to invest permanent fund assets into in-state private equity stuff, this is something that's come up here in the last six. Is this driving any of this at this time?
Through the chair, no, it is not.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in this process, if a venture capital firm were to present an investment opportunity to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, they will have already gone through their own internal due diligence before it ever gets presented to a potential client. I would say that would probably be a very likely yes. You can't speak for a venture capitalist firm, but they're not going to market an investment opportunity to their client base without having completed their own due diligence.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Yep. So when a venture capitalist firm presents an opportunity for investment to its client base, and that client base may number in the dozens, there's a particular value in that offering, X number of dollars, and it's chopped up into shares for investment by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Would that be a true description?
That is correct.
So when these are offered,
follow-up?
Thank you. When these are offered, time is of the essence. If every one of these opportunities came with a 90-day review period for the clientele base of the venture capitalist firm, then we wouldn't be having this discussion today, would we?
Ms. Rodell.
Through the chair, that is correct.
But they set the clock, not the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
That is why this time is of the essence and why we are having this discussion. So I tried to frame it in a way. Maybe it could help us understand why you are sitting here before us. Thank you.
You're definitely leading the witness, but we appreciate helping us understand. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, although I think the chair is right, it was very helpful examination of the witness. One thing I would note is there are 50 exemptions, so this would create a 51st. So this is not unfamiliar to our code. And I want to be helpful to the APFC. Ms. Rodell, I guess my only concern is how to avoid any sort of long-term coziness between the contracted party and the APFC. That's my only concern. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if we're fortunate to get this exemption, it will get reflected in the investment policy process that the Board of Trustees goes through on a regular basis in terms of laying out how that's where we lay out the process for picking fund managers, for hiring external managers to do public equity type. That process is laid out. That process is exempt from the code today. There's a regular review that the trustees do on the performance and the relationships and review those relationships and whether or not they continue. So I think that this would be embedded in the investment policy, the reporting requirements to the board as to what that looks like. And when it gets reported to the board, that by definition means it's also getting reported to the Alaskan public. Those meetings are public. So I think that I want to reassure the committee that we would have a process in place and that it would not be our intent in any way to create coziness. I understand the concern around that, and our goal is to make sure that there is a process in place that can report out and reflect on this.
Follow up.
Follow-up.
The other thing that I think I would emphasize is along with your ability to be nimble and to act quickly in these investment decisions, what you've described, and I don't have a sense of the dollars, is that the APFC would retain more of the profit from the investment that is currently going to fund managers. And I don't really have a sense of what that is, but this is all about making money for the state, and I'd like to hear more about that.
through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't know. I'm looking back at Pauline to see if she's got a net of fee report with her, but we will be reporting out at our next board meeting on May 22nd and 23rd, and I apologize for not having with it a sense of what the size of these fees in total are. So right now our carried interest profit sharing piece of it is I want to say it's in excess of $100 million. I can easily say that, safely say that today. And so I think when we look at that, we recognize that on this, in this portfolio, this asset class that we're talking about is roughly about almost $9 billion today. It returned last year, to give you a magnitude of the importance of it to the fund, it returned in FY18 almost 33%. So this is a really important, the reason we don't have the entirety of the fund in it is because it's a higher risk, it's illiquid, and all of that associated with it, and we want to have a balanced, a diversified portfolio and balance the risk on it. So, you know, so we're talking about how we invest approximately 12 to 15% of the fund. And in terms of the fees, a little bit of an, I know we're in excess of $100 million. When we pay those fees, recognize we're getting 80% that is in that return number. So these are very lucrative investments. We're getting a very good return. But we'd like to capture more of that return. And the way we capture more of that return is to reduce the levels. So there are, you can do this directly. You can do these investments through a fund. And when we first started this 10 years ago, we did what are called fund-to-funds. So we hired a fund to pick the funds for us that then picked the portfolio companies, the underlying investments beneath them. And so we have, over time now, gotten rid of almost all of the fund-to-fund category and reduced that level of expense. And now we're looking at how can we reduce our reliance on the fund managers and be able to look at portfolio companies directly and invest in those opportunities. And this bill gives us a resource to help us do that more effectively, and that's what we're asking for today.
And I think the other flip side of Representative Joseph's question was, how would we know whether or not this was the wrong way to go? Kind of explain what we might see if this was the right way, but then how would we judge? Because again, we've kind of learned our lesson, and it's not necessarily, I mean, we trust you and where you are and where you sit, but we kind of figured you may not stay with us forever, and somebody else may be sitting there. So how would we judge whether or not this, you know, that we didn't do the right, that they having those extra parameters, as Representative Carpenter said, had more meaning than what we currently understand, because procurement is very, it's a long, difficult process that many of us, I know I don't understand fully. So would we judge it by that our returns aren't as good, and therefore we weren't doing our due diligence like we were, what it calls for now? I guess I'm just trying to figure out how we would judge whether or not we should go back to what we were doing if this showed it was unsuccessful.
I think, Representative Wilson, the way I would judge it is in that return metric, because if we're now picking, so when we show you the returns each quarter, we're measuring ourselves against the passive benchmark, which is if a computer were picking the investments, a performance benchmark, which is how our active managers are doing, and then, and those two really give you a sense of how the internal corporate staff are doing over and above what our external outside of Juneau people are doing. And I think what you would start to see is that our ability to make those investments, and there's going to be market influences that create poor performance, but that's why we have those benchmarks, is to sort of take that market noise out of the performance and really understand where investment selection is driving value to the fund, is by having those two different benchmarks. And so you will see that if we're consistently underperforming, especially those performance benchmarks, and each asset class has its own performance benchmark in addition to the total return. So you'll see it on two fronts. You'll see it within the private equity asset class benchmark comparison performance, and you'll see it in the then rolled up into the total fund. And I think if we are giving too much to one contract that's giving us bad advice, that's in turn leading us to make bad investment decisions, it gets reflected in those numbers on a quarter by quarter by quarter basis.
Perfect. That's very helpful. Thank you. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes, Madam Chair. I had my questions answered, and I do support this. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I completely get the need, and I think the question that we're not asking, and I think we need to have the other individuals here, is when we look down at this list of processes, I guess, for lack of a better word, where is the value on the left-hand side? I get the value on the right-hand side because it's going to enable them to have more flexibility, but what is the value of any one of these steps on the left-hand side? I see a proposal evaluation committee, so there's a human being that has gotten together with other human beings, and they're going to evaluate a proposal, and that is good, potentially, a good review process of whether something should go forward or not. And so I don't see that the good management of public funds needs to be at odds with flexibility for the permanent fund corporation. But a complete exemption or a partial exemption may be at odds with good management issues. So the question really needs to be addressed to our own processes of why we have a procurement process in the first place, and what are we going to exempt? That really is the question that has to be answered. I get the why we need it.
Right, and we will have a procurement office. We'll reach out to the department administration, because I think that is definitely the best way to just find out why we have all those steps. And it could be, as Ms. Rodell said, is that you're trying to capture a lot of different things that have to go through procurement. And so, you know, it would be interesting to find out which part of that drove the days, you know, the length of time that we have. And so I think that would be very good to have before us. Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, and I neglected to mention this, and I wanted to. Ms. Rodell, the other thing I guess I'm curious about is what value comes from the RFP process in terms of finding expertise you wouldn't have known about. So for example, if I wanted to invest in the Arctic, I would call, as I sit here now, Fran Ulmer or Mead Treadwell. But I'm sure if I put out an RFP, there might be a bunch of people I've never heard of. And I don't know if that's true in your case. If you have a directory that guides you to names your that are predictable to you.
through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think it depends, quite honestly. I think we have a network of people we interact with that have a variety of expertises, depending on what it is we're looking or where it is we're looking to. So if we were looking to invest, for example, in Australia, into an infrastructure project in Australia, we do a lot of, we have a lot of relationships with the Australian Future Fund and with the New Zealand Superannuation Fund, the two sovereign wealth funds located in those countries. We would probably call and ask for recommendations of people to look into this on our behalf. That's how I would expect this to work. And doing an RFP process, posting it for 21 days to have no responses or to not have qualified responses makes it difficult to go down that path.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to phrase this a little different. The cost, the opportunity cost that we lose is difficult to measure if you never had a chance to make the placement.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So I suspect this procurement process was written before the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation was even formed. This has probably been the essence of this process, been in state law for decades. And how many other agencies have asked for a modification of this procurement process for the reasons that you have stated? And you probably don't need to answer that, but I suspect not very many, if any.
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, the Alaska Retirement Management Board is completely exempt from the state procurement code.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we're going to open this up to public testimony. I'm going to open public testimony to HB 139. On the line, we have Mr. Mike Coons. Mr. Coons, could you please put yourself on the record and your affiliation? You may begin your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Coons. I'm the president of the Greater Alaska Chapter of AMAC. I'm opposing this. There's several different reasons I'm opposing this. I've been sitting here listening to this testimony quite closely. So there's some things maybe I'm not going to bring up that just slipped my mind. But a couple things. The comment was made by the president of the corporation that this has been something that's been asked for over the last 3 or 4 years, and it hasn't been approved. So if it hasn't been approved over the last 3 or 4 years, why do we want to do it now? The other aspect of this that makes me really concerned is in looking at a lot of the stuff that's going on right now in different committees, different bills that are they're going after the PFD, that's going after the permanent fund. We people don't have a lot of faith in our legislature right now when it comes down to the permanent fund. And I think maybe, you know, this, if we weren't attacking the permanent fund like we've been attacking and different sponsors and people, you know, legislators doing the things they've been doing, I might go along with this, and this might make sense, because I do have a good portfolio and I do go to a fiduciary, Edward Jones, and when I have a question about a stock or a mutual fund or a bond, I can call him up and get an answer really quick, which is really great. And that's what I've seen, that's what she's wanting to do here. But we're only talking 10 to 12 times per year. Right now, there is my faith in this process right now is so low, it's below the gutter. And so I just cannot, you know, go along with this at all at this point in time. I think maybe once we get the permanent fund situation taken care of, we stop this silliness that's going on, and then the legislature regains the trust of the people, then we can maybe talk about this at a later date. But at this point in time, I cannot in any way, shape, or form, you know, support this.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. And Mr. Coons, will you be sending a letter in from AMAC on this opposition?
I'm going to try. I got an AMAC meeting here in about 15 minutes I got to go to, so I'll try and do something, you know, later this afternoon or evening. But it's just, I don't know. I can see that some of the things she's talking about. I don't, you know, I like the idea of not being able to shell out 20%. To a company, you know, for the profit. I get that. There's good things to this thing, but right now I just don't know. And there's a lot of, and Representative Carpenter's brought up a lot of good points, a lot of good questions, and I haven't really heard a solid answer. So I would say no.
But Mr. Coons, could you tell us again what does AMAC stand for?
Association of Mature American Citizens.
Okay, and so I'm just trying to, for the record, to verify whether or not you're speaking on your own behalf or you have a resolution or some decision by this organization.
I'm speaking for my chapter.
Okay, so I would hope you would be able to send in a resolution or a letter stating their position, because I just want to make sure that that everybody understands that it's the organization versus yourself. So we'll look forward to that letter that I'm assuming you already have in your possession before you testified. So thank you again for being with us.
I'll be doing it later this afternoon.
Thank you very much, which we'll look forward to that correspondence when and if it comes. So is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Mr. Morgan, did you want to testify?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can you please put yourself on the record and you can begin your testimony?
Yeah, my name is Herman Morgan from Maniac, and as you guys know, that we could see you guys on Laughter Channel. We could see you smiling, John, Ms. Johnson, at his comments. And I would like to say I'd be wary of the decisions being made by the director, the new director who's appointed by our former governor. Because last year or other years, she was practically begging the legislature to use that money to pay for their money using gas line. And, you know, I find it kind of wrong that you guys are trying to put a lot of that money from the earning reserve into the corporate fund and keep getting their dividends and for state services. And I agree. We don't trust you guys. We see what you guys did with SB-991, SB-49, and this called the permanent fund is belongs to us, and maybe the governor should look at ask her if she's still in favor of using a lot of our permanent fund to pay for that money-losing gas line to a foreign country. And we could see you guys when you guys laugh at them comments of people trying to tell you something. I remember Mark Newman, he said, you guys should listen to the people and not listen to all these people that are, I'm really concerned about the director right now, because her saying, like, please take the permanent fund money to pay for his money and use gas lines. So let you guys, we could see your reactions, you guys. Think of the people, not only the people you listen to and try to convince to give our money away to a foreign company. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Thank you for your testimony. And just for those who are listening, this is about procurement. This is not about the dividend or any other part of that at this point. That's for a different day, different discussion. Is there any other person online? Is there anyone else in the room who'd like to testify? Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to close public testimony on HB 139. We do have one fiscal note before us. Ms. Swanson, are you here to talk about it, or Ms. Riddell? Yourself back on the record.
I would be happy to, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Angela Rodell, the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We have a zero fiscal note for this bill. We do not believe that it will increase any cost to us.
And do you know whether or not the Department Administration will have to write any type of new regulations on this particular proposal?
No, they will not have to write any regulations, and we will not have to write any regulations with this.
Perfect. That's usually what drives the cost. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to set this bill aside. We will reach out to the Department Administration and see on the next hearing whether or not we could have them here as well to finish answering the questions that we had today. Any other issues on HB 139? Representative Johnston, is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, thank you.
Okay, next we're going to go to HB 87. We have Representative Thompson here with us today. I had a sheet passed out. We do have Mr. Britton on the line with us as well. What this is that I passed out is there was questions before on SETS funding, which is up $125 million, and it is a loan fund. This is not grant that was given to this project. What I would like to do, if it's okay with the committee, is I would have like Mr. Britton to come on the line and just basically explain to us where the money will come from to be able to move these storage tanks from Fairbanks into the North Pole area to finish the distribution system, and what would happen if They are not able to have the funds to be able to do that. Will they then only be able to connect Fairbanks within itself? So, Mr. Britton, if you could put yourself on the line, and again, before us, we have the schedule of sustainable energy transmission and supply loan funds as of May 9, 2019, before the committee, and it shows all the figures that you gave us. So if you could kind of walk us through where these funds would come from to be able to finish your project.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you. My name is Dan Britton. I'm the general manager with the Interior Gas Utility and here in Fairbanks. To walk you through the sources and uses for the interior funds for the interior energy project, one of the funds that was available and is available was the SETS fund, which was $125 million. As you see on the uses that we've put together on the that document, the funds that have been used so far are for expansion or installation of a gas distribution system in North Pole, just under $30 million, expansion of the distribution system in Fairbanks for just under $15 million, the large storage facility that we're constructing here in Fairbanks, are the current expenditures of $37 million. That project actually is under hydro test as we speak. The North Pole storage facility, we've expended just under $700,000 in the engineering for that facility. There was the acquisition of Pentex for the Interior Gas Utility, purchasing the existing gas utility in Fairbanks, Fairbanks Natural Gas, and the liquefaction facility in Point McKenzie. So to date, the total proceeds of $103 million used, with remaining funds of just under $22 million available. The projects that will consume that $22 million is the completion of the storage project in Fairbanks, about $18 million. Service line connections for new customers of approximately $2 million. The North Pole storage facility, we could allocate just under $1 million to that. And then the front-end engineering and design for the expansion of the liquefaction facility, which is ongoing today at $800,000. So with those projects, that will consume the availability of the $125 million. As part of the interior energy project, there was also the ability to issue up to $150 million in conduit revenue bonds through ADA with the moral obligation of the state. It is, we've hired a financial advisor and have started the process for preparing our bond package, which will include establishing a credit rating with credit agencies and moving out to the market to issue bonds. It is likely we'll be issuing our first tranche, will be approximately $75 million of bonds to cover the cost to construct the new liquefaction and these other items that we have, which is the completion of the North Pole storage facility. In the short term, while we're working on our bond placement, we have a commitment from a local bank in Fairbanks for just under $14 million of funding that we will use for the project, and we've requested access to $7.5 million, a line of credit that was in place with the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The assembly will be relooking at that in early part of June of this year, whether they will grant access to that line of credit for us. So it's with those short-term funds and then the bond financing that we will fund our future, our projects.
So the project is over $200 million currently in debt. Is that a fair statement?
No, the total indebtedness today is just the SETS fund, the $125 million will be the total indebtedness. Once we place the bonds, there will be the additional $75, which would put us at the $200 million. The SETS fund, the loans with the SETS fund have a 15-year deferral. No interest or principal payments required for 15 years. An additional five-year potential deferral to that if the conversion process are slower than anticipated. So the $125 million is very flexible debt. That's what was put in place by the legislature to allow the Interior Energy Plan to move forward through the growth years and take away some of the risks associated with the conversion.
Any further questions? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Britton, what is your liquefaction plant? What's the time frame for, I guess, start construction, end of construction, and total cost associated with that?
Through the chair, Representative, the fraction expansion is approximately a $50 million project. The time to construct is anticipated to be a two-year time frame. We have RFPs issued right now for the liquefaction and pretreatment equipment, which is part of our front-end engineering and design process. We are looking to make a final investment decision in the fall of 2019 and begin that project. So from the fall of 2019, it would be a two-year construction time frame.
Okay, thank you.
And before I go to Representative LeBond, we need to put a work draft in front of us. Sorry about that. Representative Johnston.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee adopt CSHB 8731-LS0619-U as the working document.
So hearing no objection, we have CSHB 8731-LS0619-U in front of us. The only change that it has within it is that we have lowered the, well, there's two changes. We'll have our, so I get it right, Ms. Gaddis. We write these things up for a reason, so we should utilize it. Please put yourself on the record and go through the changes with us, and then we'll go to Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on page 1, line 7, the changes, the date from January 30th, 2021 to January 1st, 2021. On page 2, lines 9A, changes $7.5 million to $5 million. And page 2, lines 10B and line 11 have been deleted. Those are the changes, Madam Co-Chair, and I'm so sorry. My name is Lynn Gaddis, staff for Chair Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we have that before us. Representative LeBond, and we'll go to Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point in time, the tanks that are under discussion, the North Pole storage facility tanks are currently located in South Fairbanks and were used by the previous entity known as Fairbanks Natural Gas. Would that be correct, Mr. Britton?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct. The part of the North Pole storage facility would be to move two tanks that given we're constructing the large storage project in Fairbanks, we would allow us to move those tanks to North Pole. In addition, we would require the installation of new vaporization equipment to vaporize the LNG.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. The project could be viewed as really two pieces, if you will. There's a Fairbanks component. The big thermos bottle or the 5.25 million gallon tank that is currently under construction and being tested will serve the core Fairbanks area and that piece of the market. The North Pole area will not be, at least at this point, not intended to be connected with the Fairbanks part of the market. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct. The two systems today are independent. They are not interconnected. It is our intent over time to connect the two systems so that we would have one system in operation. The facilities will be managed as if they're one system. Our intent is to have postage stamp rates throughout the Interior Gas Utilities service area. So they'll be managed as if they're one, but they are currently independent. The only way to, or the way that we would begin providing gas service in the North Pole system is to have this storage facility. Without it, right now, those pipes are under nitrogen pressure and do not have gas available to deliver to consumers.
Representative LeBlanc.
Another follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you look at both pieces of this market to bring clean burning natural gas, improve air quality, and all the other factors involved, how big is the North Pole piece in relationship to the Fairbanks piece? How big is the concentration of supply piping, if you will, to the North Pole community?
Through the chair, Representative, in North Pole, we have installed approximately 72 miles of distribution system. In Fairbanks today, we have approximately 140 miles of distribution system. There is plans to continue expanding the North Pole facility in phases 2 and 3, which would increase the installed mileage up to closer to the Fairbanks area. The market itself, the demand primarily comes from the Fairbanks area. So if we look at what our total demand in our system would be over time, the North Pole area makes up probably somewhere in the 35% range of our expected demand versus the more core area of Fairbanks that has a higher concentration of commercial buildings would be in the range of 65%.
Follow-up?
One last follow-up, because I know other folks have a desire for questions. The lines that would supply the clean burning natural gas to homes and businesses, are you about completed with that phase of the project, or are there more lines going in this summer?
We have, through the chair, Representative, we have completed the majority of our planned installation of distribution system for now. The next phases of expansion, which are targeted mostly for North Pole, phases 2 and 3, would come in future years as we confirm our conversion estimates are accurate and that the demand for the natural gas is there.
Thank you.
So why are the two systems separate? Why are they not connected? Because it sounds like if they were connected, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Madam Chair, up until June of 2018, the two systems were under separate ownership. In June of 2018, with the Interior Gas Utility purchasing Pentex, they're now under common ownership, and there's an opportunity to interconnect. The original Fairbanks system was not designed for expansion to North Pole through the piping network that's been installed. Connecting the two systems would allow for some service out of through the existing Fairbanks natural gas system, but ultimately we, in order to have the required pressure, we need to have the storage facility in North Pole.
Representative Knopf, did you have another question? Any other questions for Mr. Britton? Any other questions concerning this issue? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I can break things down to the, I guess, to my goal is to try to get the net impact. If we were to adopt HB 87, we were to adopt that, it's my understanding that we are extending the tax credit program by no greater than $15 million. Is that correct?
That's not correct.
$15
million? Oh. That's still not correct. Okay, but I'll help you. So we're doing two things here. We're going to extend it for 1 year.
Right.
And then if you go to page 2, it cannot exceed more than $5 million or half of the project, whichever the lower amount. It just can't exceed $5 million. So if the project goes over $10 million, then that amount of money is taken on by the Interior Gas Utility or whoever was able to take advantage of this. It also would fall underneath the tax credit program in which they would be in line of all the other credits that we currently have. That's the reason there's a zero fiscal note, not that this does not have a fiscal impact. Also, they would have to be to commercialization by this date, so it's not just putting the storage tanks in place. They would actually have to be up and running, as you heard Mr. Britton talking about, what they're, the testing they're currently doing on the Fairbanks portion of it. So we have two things going on. We have the old program, which is the $15 million that will still expire on the date as planned. This one-year extension is a much smaller footprint, up to $5 million. So if this utility is able to go under the old plan and commercialize their storage tanks by December 31st of this year, they will still be eligible for the $15 million. If they are not able to be in commercialization by then, they would then fall underneath the $5 million that is written now in this one-year extension.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the question. This is a very difficult situation as we all kind of want to be through with that whole tax credit, no more than I do, on this. And at the same time, we don't have an equalization of cost of energy from measuring out from Anchorage. I used to think that Matsu had all had gas. I learned that they do not all have gas. In fact, some of the areas actually pay more for fuel oil than we even do in Fairbanks, depending upon where they're at. And then you get into the Bush communities, which we're continually trying to do more projects so they're not so dependent on diesel fuel as well. Any further questions? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Considering a tax credit, what is the lifetime expectancy of tax revenue back to us if we do give this credit?
Representative Carpenter, there will be no tax revenue that is given to the state on this. This would be a benefit, hopefully, for the Interior, who's been paying unusually high cost for energy for a very long time, but no money for this project goes back to the state, and none of that will be paid back. The loans that we're talking about will be, but not on this particular bill.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions or concerns? We also have Representative Thompson, if anybody has anything else. Representative Ortiz.
Just because we're in this area, would this program then be, if we were to adopt this, would this $5 million be potentially a part of the bonding option that's there if the bonding option gets approved by the courts, I assume, would the people be able to take advantage of that program as well, or would they have a choice? In other words, would they get in line for the existing amounts of money that we're putting forward towards paying off these credits in general? Would they be able, is that what they would do, or would they go for the bonding, or they have their option just like everybody else would?
They would have the same option. The odds are they probably would not be part of the bonding, only because it's my understanding that once the court case has been decided, they will go out for the bonds sooner than later. With this project, because they still have a lot more work to do before they get to commercialization, they'll probably be butting up against the January 1st deadline for this to go away. So they have to be completely done with the program, put in their paperwork before they can become eligible. There's also the chance that they will not complete the program in time, and there won't be any tax credits at all. This would just be the guidelines in case they are able to get to commercialization before January 1st of 2021.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Any further questions? Representative Johnston.
Yes, Chair. Are we going to be doing going over the fiscal note for this?
So I can go to the fiscal note again. So the fiscal note is, as we say, the reason it's a zero fiscal note is because the $5 million, first of all, they would have to get the work all done, turn in all the paperwork, and then what would happen is that odds are they would not probably fall underneath the bonding program, but they could, because it's my understanding that the Department of Revenue may not put all the tax credits out in one bond. If they are not eligible at that time, they would have to wait in line behind all the other tax credits, depending upon how much is appropriated by the legislature. And if the legislature keeps doing zero, then it could be a long time and possibly not even get it. It's still by appropriation.
Thank you. It took me a minute to consume that.
Oh, that's okay. Complicated. Bill, it's something that we were hoping that would come back, and sometimes things, when you have a short construction period, can't get done as quickly as we would hope in the Interior. We like to have our snow on the ground for a very long time. Any other questions or concerns on HB 87? What is the will of the committee?
One minute, please. Yes, Madam Chair. I move CS HB 8731-LS0619-U from the committee with the individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing seen, no objection. HB 87 has passed the House Finance Committee. We will be having the document to sign to come before us. While we're doing that, we're going to go ahead and go right into HB 87. Whoops, I'm not going to do the same thing twice. Let's do an Eddie's and sign the paperwork, and we'll get the next group up here. Back on the record, next is SB 74, Internet for Schools. We heard HB 75, which is the companion bill. We took public testimony. We now have staff for Senator Hoffman, who will present his part of the bill, and we'll be very interested to hear how it's different. Will you please put yourself on the record? You may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record. My name is Meriden Borio, staff to Senator Hoffman, and he sends his apologies. He was going to try to be here, but he was called into another committee. So SB 74 is the Internet for Schools, and an act relating to funding for Internet services for school districts and providing for an effective date. I'll just briefly go through it again. I know you've heard this on the companion bill. SB 74 will increase the Internet for Schools in Alaska from 10 megabits per second to 25 megabits per second and provides funding to help schools reach the 25 megabits per second through the School Broadband Assistant Grant, the BAG. The federal E-rate program subsidizes Internet connectivity, so the actual monthly cost for public and private K-12 schools. Those federal E-rate subsidies range from payment between 20 and 90% of the internet bill for Alaska school districts. That percentage is based on need. The average is around 80%, and so then that would be the 20% is picked up by the school districts. The state-funded broadband access grant, the BAG program, was designed to help schools cover their share of the cost. So the legislator started this to help districts increase their internet speeds by helping pay the local share after the E-rate subsidy is applied. It currently provides school districts assistance to get to 10 again, and this bill proposes to increase that to 25, which means the federal E-rate subsidy will still cover the same percentage of the school's internet bill, but the school will be able to afford a bigger internet bill with additional state subsidy to cover that cost. Districts apply every year. The grants, or they're eligible to apply every year. The grants are awarded in August for the next school year. It's a voluntary program, so and I realize there's a new fiscal note, but that contains the amount that's expected to be needed should every school under 25 megabits per second take part. Any unused funds are returned to the state. And under this proposal, 170 schools in 30 school districts, which is about, it's over 20,000 students, could benefit from this bill. And Madam Chair, did you want me to let you know the change that took place in Senate Finance?
Yes, we want to do the changes first, President Ortiz said. So let's go through the changes first.
In the Senate Finance Committee, due to some question as to if this additional funding would create a problem with the disparity test, which is federal impact aid that we receive, because the funding is not equal across the districts, we were worried it would cause us to fail the disparity test. So,
when you say across the districts, are you talking urban, rural, or are you talking just all districts combined? So when you're talking, I'm just not exactly sure what areas we're talking about on the disparity portion.
Madam Chair, this, and I apologize, I do have Alexi here to go over more on the disparity test, but because the funding is different, because some districts it costs more, so they would get more federal funding from the E-rate, as well as then the state bag funding would be a bigger portion that could affect the disparity test. Did I explain that correctly? All the school districts do not get equal amount of funding.
And so what page and line are you on as far as the correction that you've made in SB 74?
Madam Chair, that change is page 2, line 6. Apologies. Page 1, line 10, it's a new section 2. And then also page 2, line 6 is the insert section 3. So that's where we put in conditional effective language. It's so the Department of Education and Early Development has time to receive certification from the United States Department of Education that we won't affect that this additional funding would not affect the disparity test.
So do we have any idea how long it takes to get this certification? Have we had to have it before?
Madam Chair, not for this. I know there are other pieces, for example, our public transportation funds are exempted from the disparity test. The department is here to speak to what they have done to get this exemption. It's my understanding they've put the request in, and we're hopeful that we will get that soon.
Ms. Teschner, please help us, or help me. Because we've heard about waivers this session, we've heard about now a certificate, and I know the federal government is not one of the fastest moving entities.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Education Early Development. Madam Chair, so it basically the certification waiver is a one and the same thing. So what we're doing is we're asking we've asked the U.S. Department of Education if the E-rate funding that districts report in their general funds can be either moved to a special revenue fund or we're just removed completely from the calculation that we do for the disparity test so that we're not breaking the 25% threshold in order to take impact aid into consideration in the foundation formula calculation.
And do we have any idea how long something like this might take, or has the department ever done this before?
Through the chair, or Chair Wilson, sorry. We are currently in a back and forth with them. So a couple weeks ago, we started this conversation with them, and hopeful that within the next couple weeks, we'll have a resolution of whether or not it can be excluded from the disparity test. So I'm hoping we're trying to move this along so we're not dragging this out.
Bridget Ortiz, did you have a question? So on the broadband access grant that we have, and we've got the 2019 awards. So it appears that that's mostly a rural grant, it's not an urban grant. So does that mean that most of our urban schools are having to pay the full amount of their internet and we're only supplementing those other areas?
Madam Chair, I guess conditionally I'd say yes. These are primarily rural schools that are affected because they, the urban schools are able to get much higher speeds and for much cheaper. So they're not applying for this grant because this grant only goes to 10 megabits per service, megabits per second. Technically, all the schools are able, or it's the grants would apply for everybody. Everybody could use them, but they don't need to because they have much better connectivity.
I've never known my school district not to want money, so I guess I'm just trying to figure out why. I mean, if they apply, would they just be turned down because they don't fall underneath whatever the application is? Because I just find it very odd that school districts, if there was extra, because I know that Fairbanks has problems with their internet service, depending upon where it's at. I mean, we can't test all on the same day because we don't have that type of connectivity. I do agree that it's probably more cost efficient than it is in some other areas. But again, if I know, like for the library funding, it does, you know, there's funding for all libraries, no matter where they're at, maybe different levels. So I'm just trying to better understand the application portion of this.
So, Madam Chair, if I might, I apologize. So all the schools and also libraries, but the E-rate funding, which is the federal portion, it's my understanding that every school in Alaska utilizes that, Fairbanks, Anchorage. So they have an amount that they want to get to that's higher than 10, and the federal government does help subsidize that. What the state has done is provide this additional one for districts that to get to, in this case right now, 10. Does that help? And so the districts that are past that are not using the state grant, but it's my understanding that every school is utilizing the federal E-rate grant program.
Right, I agree with you. They all do the E-rate. I guess I'm just trying to figure out the access grant, and it's because I'm trying to connect it then to the fiscal note. Why the fiscal note is going to be over $7 million a year, and I'm assuming that $7 million actually gets added to the $1 million of possible grant awards that can go out in the following years. Is that true?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And that, so Madam Chair, that $7 million in the new fiscal note is for the expected, if this bill passes to 25, the amount of schools that are under 25 currently. If they all apply for that, that's what that fiscal note covers. And correct me if I'm
right. So, and I didn't have this right the last time. So, we're basically for 172 schools, we're going to turn it up from anywhere between 10 and 25. Everybody's not at 10. And so, really, what we're doing with the $7 million, we're paying the additional amount of money that's going to cost us for this internet service. But then we're also saying that we're going to continue to pay that amount for years to come with basically no end because it's a grant that currently would exist within this bill.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's a grant program. I mean, obviously you can change it at any time. We do expect it to go down. That's been what has happened as schools, as technology comes to especially rural Alaska, but to the entire state, the market dictates that those prices go down.
And could you also get to us, we heard at the last hearing that most of these areas had more than one choice of providers. I don't necessarily think that's correct. So if you could just, you know, I don't expect for every school district for you to tell me how many options that they have for each provider, but I would be very interested, especially those that are on this list, you know, do they have more than one choice? If not, you know, basically what private company are we going to be giving $7 million to? Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, Chair Wilson. I might suggest that we have Christine O'Connor online, do we?
No, we do not.
Oh. Sorry. That she might be a source to answer some of your questions that you just asked as far as connectivity availability, cost of connectivity, and why maybe this is more of a rural than an urban.
Well, I understand all those things. I want the committee to understand that if we pass this bill, we're going to be paying an additional $7 million every year for an internet bill that some of these districts are already paying, as we heard, over $25 million from within. The only question I would have, because that's where it came from, is that she could get us the information on the competition that was brought up that I truly don't believe, but we can find out whether or not we can find out what that competition is today. Ms. O'Connor, would you like to come to the table and help us understand better who, how many companies are out there in each of these regions to be able to compete for this $7 million?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christine O'Connor. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association. And thank you for hearing my testimony earlier this week. This question did come up, and I went back to my members and basically asked them where, you know, confirm where you're serving, how many servers, how many providers are in each area. And the solid answer I got back is that in virtually every area, there are a minimum of two providers. Because we have a satellite provider that covers the whole state and is very active in bidding on E-rate contracts. Most, if virtually all locations also have an existing landline provider that will bid on fixed broadband services. And in fact, the E-rate rules require every existing landline provider to bid on E-rate RFPs. So, with those two factors, most areas, virtually all, will have two providers. In many areas now, you have three or even four. The Nome School District went out for their RFP within the last year or so, and it was really vigorous competition there, even got a little press coverage. You had, I think it was four different providers bidding on that contract and driving down the rates. I think that's why you saw the 37% decrease in broadband rates to schools last year. It's just through that very vigorous process. And you're seeing a couple things happening. New partnerships amongst the providers. So you will see, for instance, in the North Slope areas, you have Alaska Communications and Quintillion bidding together at times. The satellite company DRS bidding together with other companies. So that's one factor helping. The other thing is E-rate rules encourage the school districts to bid together as consortia, which that makes that a more attractive contract for the providers to go after. So all of these factors have just developed over the last couple of years and are really driving those rates down and bringing competition. Not to say that there still aren't gaps. We still need a lot more infrastructure, but it's a really rapidly changing market.
So if we could get that information so we could better understand that, and in the last couple of years, has some of these districts actually seen a drop in their internet costs? Because I know the one that we heard from the other day, they've been up there in a pretty large amount for a long time, so I don't see any, I haven't seen any specific drops in their rates, but to better understand the competition. So we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about the fiscal note, is it appropriate at this time?
Absolutely.
Thank you. How does the fiscal year 1910 megabit program numbers predict the fiscal year 21 25 megabit program numbers?
Through the chair, for the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So we're taking the average of what is FY19's school broadband assistant grant, the average of that, in order to determine a cost if every school district were to be, if all the 172 wanted to go up to 25 megabits and applied. So we have to take, we're taking the average because that is the most, that's the best information that the department has in order to determine an approximate cost of what this would, what this program would cost from 10 to 25.
Follow-up question. The fiscal note talks about the need to continue funding the 0 to 10 megabits coverage in it. It says in tandem, and I'm not sure if that means in addition to the current fiscal note of 7.1. So does that mean that we're actually really talking about those two costs being added together, although it's not reflected on this fiscal note? So we're looking at an 8.6 million, not a just a 7.1.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that is correct.
Okay.
So why is it not reflecting what Representative Carpenter is thinking about his next question? So why on the FY 2020 would it not show the $1 million that are currently going out there in these grants? Because we are providing money for the grants currently.
Madam Chair, we were when we first developed this fiscal note, it was, my understanding was everything was included, the 0 to 10 plus the 10 to 25, and we were told to make sure that the fiscal note only reflected the 10 to 25 costs to provide the legislature with what that additional cost to the program would be, which is why the note is reflected in the analysis section that the 1.4 and change needs to be included, needs to be funded as well to continue the 0 to 10 program.
So I'm not sure whose idea that is, but that should have been up on the FY 2020 at the cost right now. The other thing that was brought up on the last hearing that we had was that before we would be changing this from 10 to 25, that each district would have to show where they would be able to get the funds to be able to do that. If they were able to fund from 10 to 25, once it was turned up to that initial $7 million, then why would we then be moving up the grants as well? If I'm able to afford it as a school district, because I'm going to ask to be able to do this, I guess we give you the initial money to get there. I've shown the department that I'm able to continue that service. If that's true and they can, then why do we have this fiscal note of $7 million?
Madam Chair, the fiscal note obviously is, it's just an estimate. And as we, if you look at the program from it originally started, it's decreased quite a bit from when we first started the 0 to 10 program, just so that folks know. So if I'm understanding and answering your question correctly, so pardon me.
Let me rephrase it because you're not getting there, but so I just may not have said it right. So we asked the question of, you know, because, you know, before we go ahead and give the money to do from 10 to 25 or whatever that range is, the question was, will that district then, once they get up to 25 megabytes, be able to show the department that they'll be able to continue the cost on their own? We were told, yes, that they would have to. Mm-hmm. So if they had the funds to be able to continue it on their own with the E-rate plus what we give them within the BSA, why would these grants then be necessary?
So, Madam Chair, this is a voluntary program, so districts aren't required to apply to us. When they do, it's based on so right now, I'm just gonna use the 0 to 10 program as an example. So November of 2014 is the baseline for when they told us what their costs were for the internet services to get to what they've been paying. If they've gone up, if their costs get below that level, they no longer qualify for this program. So they may continue to pay through their base student allocation and their E-rate funding for the services that they provide, but the cost that they've received from their providers is less, so they would no longer qualify because they would have been able to get a discount, or not discount, but their overall cost is decreased. So it's based on a baseline number, and Patients for Ignition runs this program in the libraries, archives, and museums, and would be better able to explain exactly how the process that her section does to review the applications and the specific information that they receive from the districts.
We could bring her up, but I guess what I'm not understanding is if they can afford to do it, which we heard that that's what they have to be required to do, then, I mean, I'm not blaming any school district for going to get funds that are out there in a grant form, but if they're able to afford it, why are we going to continue in the times that we have right now to say we're going to have these grants up to $8 million when in reality they could pay for it? But of course, if I can get money from somewhere else, I'm going to. And so we'll bring the individual up and have her testify now.
Okay.
The sponsor of the bill could stay, though. I didn't want everybody to run away. You please put yourself on the record and just help me understand that if these districts can't afford it, because that was the process to start with, why would we continue to have $8 million worth of grants out there?
For the record, Patience Fredrickson, Director of the Alaska Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums, part of the Department of Education. It is on the E-rate application that the schools certify that they can pay the remaining portion of the bill. They only apply for the E-rate if they know that the school bag funding is there. Before the E-rate window opens, we're getting constant phone calls. Is the school bag at 10 going to go forward? Should we apply for 25? They can't apply for 25. They couldn't apply for 25 this year because they did not know if this bill was going to be in place and the funds available for next year. That's why the school bags schools will be applying for 10 at this, they've applied for 10 for next year. Once school bag is in place, then when they do their E-rate application next March, they will be able to say, yes, I can afford the remainder of the cost to get to 25 because they know that the school bag funding will be available. It's not on the state application for school bag that they certify this. It's on the federal application for E-rate.
So all this bill is really doing is saying how much money are we willing to put into further money, because we're putting a lot of money within the phase two and allocation as well as this. So this really isn't about turning it up to from 10 megabits to 25 megabits. It really is about the out years, how much money that the state is willing to put into this program.
That's correct, but it is, the whole program was designed to give the schools enough money to lift them from one level of E-rate, say 5 to 10, for the first few years of the program. And now we're promising through this bill and the funding that in the next fiscal year that they will have enough money that they're expecting from us to get to 25 in combination with their own funds.
So why wouldn't we just adjust the base due and allocation if this is part of the cost of doing business versus, again, this would fall outside the base due and allocation?
I actually do not know the answer to that, Chair Wilson. I'm not conversant on the base student allocation. I would expect it's because it's in combination with the E-rate program. The genesis of this program of School Bag, it is based on the Online with Libraries project. That project helped libraries get up to a certain amount of internet so that they could have a video conference network. And the idea in OWL was to combine E-rate funding, library funding, and grant funding to get those libraries up to a high enough speed that they could do video conferencing. School Bag is based on OWL.
But online with libraries goes to all districts, does it not? Do they not all receive some type of funding?
No, online with libraries goes to the subsidy goes to only about 20 public libraries at this point. The online with libraries video conference network is in every public library, so it's two portions of the program. The video conference network hits every public library, but the funding is not so much. I suspect that the reason School Bag is structured the way it is because it is based on the library program.
So if you get us those two lists, it's been a while since I've looked on the online with libraries just to get a better understanding of what libraries and how much they are. And I thought that for both of them, but it's probably been 8 years since I've looked at those particular numbers, and it could have possibly changed. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair, to take a turn over this way. If I remember correctly, and we might ask Ms. O'Connor back up, when NOME had almost their bidding war on their contract, it seemed that by keeping it down at the 10 versus maybe bringing it up to 25, we actually were making it more expensive for the connectivity. Could somebody speak to that? I'm going back in my memory, but is somebody aware that I think there were some companies that could make it cheaper for the higher 25 megabytes than they could for, because they had more available than the 10.
Ms. O'Connor, if you please put yourself back on the record and answer the question, please.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. For the record, Christine O'Connor, Alaska Telecom Association. Representative Johnston, I'm not familiar with the details, but that does make sense. NOME has relatively good connectivity at this point. They have multiple providers. They have the new fiber quintillion project coming in. So when you've got relatively larger bandwidth, you can kind of buy in bulk, so to speak. So 10 megabits is very small. And so if you could get the larger components, it's probably proportionally cheaper. But again, I'm unfamiliar with the exact details.
Representative Johnston.
Could I do a follow-up? So as I look at this fiscal note and as I look at sort of improved technology, this could be an issue in the rest of the state as we get the low orbital satellites. I think there's maybe one or two that might be coming online within the next couple of years, and maybe as some, we're not sure what Cotillion's going to go, what direction, but as competition increases, while this fiscal note is high and it goes out number of years, it could be coming down due to the improved technology. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, yes, there are multiple projects coming online in the near future. There's been big announcements in the news recently of more bandwidth coming into the state. Every company is taking advantage of newly stabilized federal funding to bring more connectivity. The low Earth orbit satellites are a bit farther out and more uncertain. The technology is untested. We have spent a lot of time with OneWeb, my members and I. They seem to be shifting their focus to other areas than Alaska at this point, but we continue to stay in contact. There are more let's watch, and when they get here, it could be amazing, but for the imminent future, we are focusing on what we can do here in state.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, and that is the experience of the school bag program. In the first year of operation, the average school bag award was in the neighborhood of 30,000. Over 5 years, the average school bag award fell to 17,000, as shown in the fiscal note. And in fact, what happened is that as the cost of internet decreased for them to get to 10 megabits per second, the mathematical formula in the application, they went under that November 2014 benchmark. They were getting 10 megabits per second for what they used to pay for five, and they literally fell out of the program because the cost stayed at this level and their bills had come down. And so that's why we went from 135 schools at one point down to 80 in FY19.
Thank you.
And I guess, you know, for this committee, does this belong in the base due allocation? We're going to be moving up from about $1 million down to up to $8 million, and there's not a very equal way of splitting that at this point. But this is an ongoing cost that we need to take serious because, as we're in the times that we're in, are we going to take on another obligation? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think at the risk of trying to predict what the future holds, and as far as costs are concerned, the discussion should also be that the federal government standard is 100 meg per second. So while we're talking about an increase to get to 25, it is cost prohibitive for us to get to 100 at this point. So as we go into the future, I would only imagine that the discussion will be, once we have 25, what's it going to take to get us to 50, 75, 100, if that's the standard that we're all going to be pushing towards. Are there currently low Earth orbit satellites over Alaska right now?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, no, there are not.
Okay. A question regarding the proportion, how we came to the 7.1 million. I'm not sure who I'm addressing the question to. The school bag increase from 10 to 25 is 7.1, and it says it's a proportional. We talked to an individual administrator from the school district in the previous meeting, and he did not know, and maybe he had the numbers, he just didn't have them in front of him, but he was unaware of what the cost was for his district to jump from 10 to 25. So how do we know this? And my understanding is this proportion is just an estimate. So how do we know this was actually going to cost 7.1?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, this is an estimate. It's based on the current cost, as you can see. The problem is that the E-rate application is a competitive bid process. The school districts list the schools and what megabits per second they want for that school. It goes into the E-rate computer system, and then the individual providers go in and they put bids on each school that they can serve.
I understand the process of how we purchase, but we don't put a bid in to find out if we can afford it.
It's just that it's confidential. The whole process in within the E-rate system is confidential, and therefore we don't have that information.
But is it confidential to the school district? Because I think that's the question, is we asked the school districts themselves whether or not, and we did get one response back that we'll make sure it gets out, but so I'm applying as a school district, and I know this program's out there, but I don't know whether or not exactly how much money I will qualify for. So as I'm putting my application to E-Rates and they're asking me how I'm going to pay for it, first of all, I would hope they would know right away how much they would be on the hook for. But then how do they know at that point in time how much they're going to get from this grant program when they have to go through a separate application process? Or would they?
Chair Wilson, if we were to go to this 25 megabit per second bill, we will re-benchmark all of the schools possibly in January 2020 and say, what are you paying for internet right now? And the school bag program going forward, they will never pay more than they are paying in January 2020 going forward. So we freeze their cost. So every year after that, when they apply for E-rate, they will know what their cost will be, and they will rely on us, the school bag program, for the remainder. In the first year of the school bag program, am I not answering this question? I may not be answering this question.
Mr. Carpenter, you take a shot at it.
Let me shift and just use an analogy here. A business decides that it wants to jump from 10 to 25 meg.
Okay.
It isn't going to go to its bank account and say, hey, I've got this amount of money. I'm just going to fork it out there, and we'll jump to how much ever bandwidth I can get. They're going to go to a provider and say, can you give me a quote? And then I'm going to know whether I've got enough money to spend on this this increase. Okay, we've got the exact opposite going on right now, where the government is asked to continue to foot over 1.4 and increase it by 7.1 without knowing what the cost actually is. And so this is a backwards process that the rest of the business world doesn't operate like this. So the point is, if a school district wants to move from 10 to 25, they ought to know, if they're being good stewards of the people's money, they ought to know how much that's going to cost. Not just ask the state government, to foot the entire bill regardless of what it costs. So that's the question. How do we know that 7.1 is the actual cost? And I think the answer is we don't.
Through the chair, we do not. It is based on the current program and some cocktail napkin figures. It's the best we could come up with, or it would have been an indeterminate fiscal note.
I don't think I trust the cocktail napkin.
Sorry.
One portion of that, but would you like to weigh in, ma'am?
Madam Chair, again, for the record, this is Meriden Boreal, staff to Senator Hoffman. And I absolutely understand what you're saying, and I think it is confusing because the school districts get the money first from the federal government, and that's why they don't know. And as Patience was trying to explain, and it's possible that Christine can clarify a little bit how they go to bid these contracts and based on how much money they know that they can apply for the E-rate. And I don't know if that makes it clearer or less clear.
Well, I think the issue is that we're going to be supplementing. First of all, I don't know why the base student allocation itself would not already fulfill it. When they fill out the E-rate, they're not saying that the school district itself can pick up the cost, because as we already just heard, they can only pick up the cost if they're able to get a certain amount from this grant. And I think that's kind of where the concern is, and they're going to need that money. And it possibly could lower, but I mean, at least up to this amount. It could be more, depending upon how many people there, how many can actually. I mean, you may be in an area where you only have one provider. You may be one that has two or three. You might get into some type of warfare that obviously they did in Nome. Hopefully, they benefited from it on that. So I think that, you know, the really question is just, it was my understanding, at least at the last hearing, that the school districts had the money to be able to do it. I did not understand at that time that they were dependent upon a grant to fulfill that portion of it. So,
Madam Chair, and if I might, it's these school districts that can't get there on their own. We're talking at this point rural school districts. I think you saw the map. I guess if that
right, but the testimony was that they could, and so now we're hearing that I think we all understood that they may needed help to get from 10 to 25. But it wasn't made clear that was only because of the funding to get to 10 to 25 really is an ongoing cost from this point on. And the only change really would be is that if internet gets cheaper, which it has, or, you know, another provider possibly moves in and they have another opportunity to lower the cost. But what we're okaying in this bill is that, you know, this is an amount that's going to go forward with not getting any more than the initial 10 to 25 that we are. And then I couldn't even imagine what the cost would be if we were going to go from 25 to 100 as well. Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. About 5 minutes ago or so, there was some testimony that part of the district application was private or proprietary. Can you repeat what that was?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when the school districts go into the E-rate computer, they say what schools they have and which ones, how much broadband they want for each one. Then the internet service providers, GCI, DRS, go into the same computer system and they submit bids for each school. That's the proprietary information. That's the information we can't tease out in response to a question of what it's actually really going to cost to fund this program at 100% every year. I can tell you in the first year of the program, we received $5 million, an allocation from the legislature, and only $3.5 million was used in that first year, and it has fallen every year since then. So we figured high on the first program. I don't know if we've done the same on this one.
Okay.
If we're going to take one more question, then I think that the sponsor of this has probably heard her questions more than they want to. But I'm going to ask that they, you know, respond back or check with members and make sure that we're all on the same. It's not my intent, because I could tell it's not the will of the committee to move this bill today. There's way too many questions and concerns on it. So Representative Josephson, and then we're going to set this bill aside and allow those conversations to be able to happen and bring them back again before us.
Through the chair, Ms. Fredrickson, you said that you indicated one district, for example, had paid $35,000 and the cost dropped to $18,000 and they fell out of the system or out of qualifying for the program, essentially. So if they're in REAA, at that point, they just have to absorb the costs through the base student allocation. Is that?
Through the chair, yes. But bear in mind that if a school district dropped out of school bag, it was because what they had been paying in November 2014 for less than 10 megabits, they were now getting 10 megabits at less than that November 2014 baseline. And so if they chose not to apply because it was to their financial benefit, it was because the cost had gone under the previous amount, that the competition had driven that cost down.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Good. So again, there seems to be many questions and concerns about this particular bill. So I would ask the sponsors, please go around and check with members and also answer the questions that we put on record today. I'm also going to suggest that start following your emails. We're down to our last 4 days of session. I'm not going to be canceling meetings until we know absolutely there's no bills to come before us or back before. So any other questions or concerns to come before the committee? Representative Josephson.
Just to clarify then, for the remainder, there's two more hearings scheduled today, and we're sort of in a on-call standing or status. Is that it?
Very well put, Representative Josephson.
Thank you.
So seeing and hearing no other concerns, it is 11:08 a.m., and we are adjourned.